Ladies and gentlemen, Suki MMA is back for UFC Vegas 271. And, you know, I did mention last week there are going to be a few changes around here, but even with Adesanya cards coming up again, you know, it made me do some homework. And as of March 13th, we're officially going to be a year old here at Suki MMA. So thank you for the support. It's been amazing meeting the people that I have and having the conversations that I have. And to be quite honest, with a one-year-old and a booming chef career on my hands last year, I thought we did a pretty good job. We got to cover PFL, we got to cover Bellator, had some incredible interviews. And to be quite honest, analyzing these fights and having some fun making picks with everybody and making some money together has been pretty much the big thing for us. So we're going to keep that going. But the big thing for us in 2022 is going to be consistency. So as of this week, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, expect the official Pick'em show for Suki MMA to be out on YouTube and Spotify. So if you're an audio, if you're a video person, by all means, check out the show. It's every Wednesday, 1 p.m. on YouTube and Spotify. And as always, wait for the picks every Friday night or Saturday, depending on when the Twitter account for the UFC releases that beautiful little graphic that everyone loves to use. I personally love to use it too. And I like to wait for the weigh-ins too. The timing works out very well. So picks will be up on Instagram and Spotify whenever that beautiful graphic and the weigh-ins are done. And like I said, Wednesday, 1 p.m. on YouTube and Spotify for the official show. Really excited to get that going in a bigger way. And yeah, so with that said, let's get into how we've only gone under 500 for the last three cards in 2022. So, I mean, overall, we've gone 15-19, but 2-1 on the Super Saiyan pick. If I haven't stressed it before, the Super Saiyan pick is the, you know, the one lock that we try to roll with together from a betting world perspective. And, you know, Miles Johns last week wasn't exactly the best pick. And, you know, with how well we did on that card from a personal betting perspective overall, it kind of rubs me the wrong way that we went with such a south pick for the Super Saiyan pick. So I'm going to work on that and make sure it doesn't happen again, especially for such a beautiful card like UFC 271. But overall, for UFC Vegas 47, we went 6-7. 2022, we're 15-19, as I mentioned, 2-1. And overall, 405, 243-5. We're 155, 81-2 in our last 20 UFC cards, 69, 34-1 on our last 20 main cards. And the Super Saiyan pick, 18-11 and 13-6 in our last 19. And so the big thing that we do differently here versus a lot of other places is after the analysis, we break down both fighters, which is my favorite part to do anyway. We're going to guess a line that Vegas thinks it's going to be, because with that information, we're not only going to be able to see where Vegas actually sees these fighters, but it gives us an opportunity to see if we, based on what I think, have an underdog value to take advantage of. So those are the big things for me, and you'll always see me mention opening lines, because even when you get to fight night and you see the lines that they are before the fight, or even if you're a live bettor, that opening line is so important to keep in mind. So if I had one piece of advice in any sport really, but in MMA especially, is where did Vegas put that opening line and where did the public drive the price till the point where fight night kicks off? So we haven't been doing so well in 2022. Hopefully the new commitment level gets us some good juju, but we're ready to take off for UFC 271. So let's kick that into gear. We've got Jeremiah Wells and Mike Matheda, also known as Blood Diamond, kicking us off in the prelims. And so what are we going to get in this fight? Big energy. I really believe that this is a culmination of ferociousness. And I think the way that we see this is Jeremiah Wells, he's got those big, looping, powerful strikes, and he's just such a hungry-looking fighter when he's in there, and I think that's where you get that forward pressure, the pace. And the thing for me is it's really hard to find tape on Blood Diamond, but even Kai Kara of France put out a tweet with a clip of his kicks and the type of finish that we might be able to see from him. Now, you see some good things, you see some bad things, right? Like the way that he's so willing to take volume punches. I think in MMA, it's not just punches, right? You open yourself up for takedowns and all that kind of stuff. But he's well on his way to being suited for this level. And the one area in this fight where I think that Blood Diamond might be just getting a tougher side opponent for a debut in the UFC is Jeremiah Wells is a Philadelphia-based fighter. That regional scene is one of the toughest in the United States. He's a CES and a CFFC champion. The guy's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. It's just the experience that he has even already, coupled with the fact that he can switch those levels and he's got that real experience as a BJJ black belt. I think that's the area where you're going to see if that's enough to take a guy down and just submit him with ease. Because if Blood Diamond comes in with enough defense there, I think that that's going to be an area where kicks, combos, in and outs, that's what you want to see from him, to be able to, you know, pull away with this fight. I think that even when you watch some of his clips, his ability to kind of read punches, even when he's taking all that damage, it's kind of how Izzy fights, right? Even if he's trying to look through his guard, he's finding openings to then land counter shots. Izzy's a god at doing that. And I think that that was some of the things you do see from Blood Diamond in some of his clips. And so, for me, I actually think that he does have that power opportunity early in a fight, catch someone, you know, kind of sleeping and coming in too hard, the same way that Robert Whittaker was getting caught in that first fight. So, I really think that Jeremiah Wells deserves to be a favorite here. I think that Vegas should put him around that minus 190 range. I think that aesthetically going over that minus 200 makes him an unattractive guy for especially an Izzy-based fighter. But 190, I think, makes sense to me. And I think that unless he deals with a very serious striking game, he should have a very winnable fight on his hands. So let's take a look here. Wow, so opening line minus 200. So my minus 190 for Vegas was pretty close there, but it's moving up, guys. It's already at minus 230 at some places. And Blood Diamond now, not too shakeable, but I'm seeing a very, you know, high ceiling line of plus 190 for some of you. If you have mybookie.ag or whichever one that is, I think that's the one to consider. I've seen a lot of these Bodogs, mybookie, betonline.ag with all the fighters doing their promos, but I personally, I think Jeremiah Wells will be my pick for that one. It's a little early to say. Like I said, official picks will be out Saturday on Twitter and Instagram. But that's an interesting one for me. I'm going to, you know, put a pencil in that, because that line keeps rising. You're going to want to get in on it early. Next fight, you know, I think this is actually one of my personal fight of the nights. And the reason why is I love Sergey Morozov as a potential prospect, but then I absolutely love Douglas Silva de Andrade as a underrated superstar. Now, the reason why I say this is because you have to be a true diehard to know what Douglas Silva de Andrade brings to the table, not just from an aesthetic perspective, but that experience, man. When you think about the fact that he has just four losses in the UFC, and they are to Tukugov, Rob Font, Jan, and Lerone Murphy, I mean, those are elite fighters, very elite fighters. And Lerone Murphy is one of the new ones to step onto that echelon, if you will. So I like both guys in this fight when it comes to, you know, mixing it up, level changes. But when you look at the way Douglas Silva de Andrade fights in the first round, I think it really is important for, you know, Morozov to have that patience and that distance ability to kind of be in and out with his strikes. He's got really good level changes, and I think that we've seen in the previous fights. I mean, who wants to fight Umar Nurmagomedov for their debut? But, you know, I think after that, especially against Taha, we saw him really kind of step his game up in terms of level changes, being able to use his striking game and then get it to the ground and just control. And I think in this fight specifically, you're going to see both guys who have that skill set. And I think it's going to come down to who makes the most mistakes. I think that Andrade does have a power edge in that first round. And so if he can land big, Morozov might have a lot on his hands there. But outside of that, if this goes three rounds, you know, I want to lean Morozov as a pick. I just think that he's young. I think that he's hungry. I think that he's going to be able to do a lot of the things that might take this to a close three round, you know, maybe even a split decision against a guy like Andrade, who's going to be so well versed in all areas of the fight. And for me as a line, I think that makes the most sense for Andrade to be about a minus 140 favorite. You think about how well he knocked Gaetano Pirello in his last fight. It's like recency bias and Vegas lines kind of go hand in hand, right? So for me, Andrade about a minus 140 makes sense here. But I think Sergey Morozov is a very real underdog here with, you know, true betting potential. So let's take a look here. And I'm obviously way off with this one. It looks like Douglas Silva de Andrade might be the dog to consider here. Morozov, even as a favorite, you know, he was my pick here, but I'm a little surprised that at some lines at minus 225. I think that Douglas Silva de Andrade, even a lot of these fights are later in his career, so it's not going to be so far off in terms of, you know, tape that we can use to study him. So for me, I think that Andrade has that skill, but for me, it's going to be rounds 2 and 3 to see what happens there. And I think the line suggests that Morozov is going to be able to deal with those early round heroics from Andrade and really pull away there in the second and third round. So I like the line. I think it makes sense for me. Even parlaying the first two favorites kind of look a little, opportunistic for me. But that's obviously going to take some time to study a little bit further. Next up, we got AJ Dobson and Jacob Malkoon. Now, this is a very interesting fight for me for a couple of reasons. Now, Jacob Malkoon, when you talk about just the interesting case that he's been in the UFC. I mean, this guy was what you would consider, you know, football players would call this, or even basketball players, like a walk-on. I mean, this guy was basically a UFC 254 walk-on as a Robert Whittaker training partner. He was on there as a fill-in. The whole Khabib Gaethje card was absolutely insane. Such an incredible, that was my most winning card of all time, actually. But with that said, Jacob Malkoon, Phil Hawes, Phil Hawes finished him very quickly in that fight. It actually set a pretty bad standard for Malkoon, who in his next fight against a guy like Al Hassan, who we, always used to consider very dangerous on the feet, but he's been finished on the feet. He's also been extremely dominated on the ground, and Jacob Malkoon ate that up. I think he got his first UFC win in very strategic style, and that's where, for me, that's what you have to analyze MMA as. It's a game plan, it's strategy. It very much is a game for some of these guys, and the way Izzy talks about it, it's a game, and he's just trying to be the best player at it. And so in this sense, Malkoon, let's take a look at the numbers for that fight. I think that's where you have a bit more of an understanding of where I think there's a hole here in this game. So Malkoon was 8 for 24 in takedowns. Now, when you think about that, that's a lot of attempts over the course of a 3-round fight. And when you think about the fact that 48 total significant strikes were even landed in that fight, I'm almost certain that AJ Dobson has thrown at least 20 in the first round of any fight he's been in over the last few years. You look at his tape, you look at the way he fights. I'm sorry, but Jacob Malkoon has to be ready to be a lot quicker in those decision makings. Al Hassan, for example, is one of those technical strikers who's going to try to pinpoint those spots. He might even put his head down and throw a couple if he needs to, but for the most part, it's technical pinpoint style power striking. But in this case, watch AJ Dobson's tape. He has zero fear in moving in. He goes up and really tries to hammer it home very early in the fight. Some of the power shots he's able to land, not only can you say that he throws with intent, but he also has that power in his back pocket to really land some big shots. And for me, you think about the way Jacob Malkoon lost that first fight, and you also think about the fact that, Dobson is a Mark Coleman trained fighter. So let alone being able to be aware of the level changes and defend those takedowns, but then also be able to implement some of his own and get that ground and pound game going that he's probably been working on so much over the course of his life. Strategically and style-wise, I feel like Dobson just has a really, really good debut fight here on his hands. And you think about the fact that he's got a 3-inch reach advantage in a fight where exactly what he wants to do is keep the distance and use his long strikes, which he does very well. It makes sense for me to take Dobson, not only as a pick even this early, but I like him as a minus 160 line from a Vegas perspective, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's even a bit higher. So let's take a look. AJ Dobson, minus 160. Wow. All right. So I've been nailing opening lines outside of this last fight, but minus 170 opener for Dobson, and he has moved very quickly all the way to the minus 120 to minus 110 range, with Malkoon coming all the way up to a pick'em. So pretty surprising to see this fight as a pick'em. I think in my mind, I not only had Dobson as a slight favorite, but also as my pick. And so to see this line, I'm happy to get the value back from that minus 170 opener, but at the same time, it makes you think how good of a game plan Malkoon's gonna have to have as a wrestler to be able to take on what Dobson's gonna bring to the table, especially early. It's gonna be quick on your feet thinking, a lot of fight IQ to be able to deal with that. And I think as long as the game plan and all of that lines up within the first 3 to 4 minutes, I think he might have a shot here. But outside of that, I think Dobson's way of fighting is just exactly what Malkoon might not want to deal with. And so that takes us right into the Carlos Ulbrich and Fabio Chiarot fight. Now, for me, I really think that Fabio Chiarot does not get the dues that he deserves from an MMA perspective. The guy was the LFA champion before stepping in on short notice and taking on Alonzo Menifield. Menifield ended up winning by Von Fluchoke. Then his only next fight after that, he ended up getting finished by William Knight. So for me, I just think that it's kind of like a tale of two tough fights, and you know, coming off of an LFA title win and then going into, you know, legitimate being thrown to the wolves, it's a tough go for him. And so when you think about what he brings to the table, and now gets a guy like Carlos Ullberg, who also, in my opinion, was thrown to the wolves. Now, decision making wise, game plan wise, did he try to go for the absolute beautiful finish early in the fight? Yes. But did he just happen to do it against a guy like Kennedy Njuku, who might have some of the best cardio in the UFC? I mean, it's really good. That's where I think, from a game planning perspective, from a technical output perspective, that's where that fight was just, you know, kind of got away from Carlos. But in this one, not only does he have kind of some tape to go on, both from an LFA perspective and a UFC perspective, but there's opportunities there, especially from that chin, you know, showing its ugly head in the night fight. I mean, there's just so much opportunity for both guys to improve, and I think that's what makes this fight so fun. And you know, we're going to talk about some best bets, and I really think that an under in this fight is something to consider. Now, is actually going to pull up, I like to use bet365, because I really do believe in most sports they have very competitive lines, at least as a guideline. So if I go here and just take a quick look, I mean, for me, the under, I mean, maybe a parlay piece at minus 250 for 2.5 rounds, but the fight to not go the distance is minus 334. And unfortunately, I just, unless that's another parlay piece for something else, I just don't see that having much value there. But, you know, interestingly enough, I did not look at the line there, and I do think that this one should be a pick 'em in my own perspective, but I think the LFA title, I think the experience in MMA, and I think that there is an understanding that Fabio Chiron just hasn't gotten his dues yet, puts him at about a minus 115 to a minus 120 line for me. So I do think it should be a pick 'em. So let's take a look here. Wow. Okay, so Fabio Chiron is a plus 155 underdog, with Carlos Ullberg opening as a minus 180. So all of this is moved. So now Fabio Chiron is now getting over plus 200 type of money, while Carlos Ullberg is a minus 250. Now, that already strikes me very curiously, because like I said, Fabio Chiron is pretty experienced, man. I think that when you talk about guys who win LFA titles, those aren't nobodies. Even at a 7-3 record, you know, you talk about his come up and you talk about the guys he's had to fight in the UFC. I think that's such a, you know, telling of just how difficult it's been for him to find some footing as not only a fan favorite, but just a guy who can kind of get a win in the UFC. So that line is very telling of some recency bias against Fabio Chiron, in my personal opinion. I definitely don't have a pick on this fight yet. I really do want to see the weigh-ins. I want to see these guys face off, see what they look like. But that's a dog or pass unless that Ullberg line comes all the way down under minus 150 or minus 140 for me. I mean, I don't even know if I would touch this fight in general from a betting perspective. But even from a pick perspective, I really am leaning towards Fabio Chiron in this one, and I think that line is just highly criminal when you really think about just, you know, 5 of his 7 wins are via chokes. So if Chiron needs to take this fight to the ground, he definitely can. And I'm not saying that there's zero ground game there for Carlos Ullberg, but I mean, for that line to be where it's at based on Ullberg's experience and Fabio Chiron's, you know, skills, it's just wow. I'm shocked. Next up, Alexander Hernandez and Renato Moicano. Now, from the outset, I've been hearing a lot of good bump for Alexander Hernandez. And I mean, here's the problem with this fight, right? Is how is this fight going to go in the first round? Will 100% dictate the fight for both guys, right? Alexander Hernandez, no matter what he does, you know, great first round fighter, tends to fade later in the fight. And to be honest, like that Benil Dariush knockout is starting to become a little forgotten because of just the back. He's a veteran. You know, we're starting to see that back and forth type of style from him. And for me, you know, you talk about a guy like Renato Moicano, people talk so much about his, you know, featherweight career, but the guy took on the absolute legends of the division. I mean, Aldo, Ortega, and I think Chen Sung Jung are the losses, and then he goes to lightweight, and I mean, he's 2-1 at lightweight, and the one loss is against Rafael Fiziev, who's looking like a, you know, shortlist title contender over the next year or two. So, I mean, for me, it's just, it's a battle of, not only the MMA math, but also just what you've seen on tape. And for me, Moicano, chin problems, yes. Alexander Hernandez, powerful, yes. But if this fight gets out of the first round or it goes to the ground, I mean, there's a lot of bump to be given for Renato Moicano from an MMA perspective. And I think that when you talk about how good, you know, Alexander Hernandez in the first round, I mean, he's really got to land those powerful shots, but he just gets so tired later in the fight. And I don't think Moicano has that problem. He's willing to get into those dirty areas, especially when he doesn't feel that power coming back at him. So outside of the first round, you kind of got to give Moicano some edge here. But inside that first round, I think that's where a lot of people are potentially leaning towards Hernandez, with that knockout power and the ability to really throw those kind of 1-2 style powerful combos. He's not a 3-4 5 punch kick style combo kind of person. But, you know, you look at the fights like the Grootsmachers and things like that, you know, I just, it's not buying me in, man. It's one of those guys that he's already proven himself to us where the Grootsmachers are concerned. So now we got to see him against some of the, you know, higher talent on a more consistent basis. And, you know, I think that humbling experience with Donald Cerrone will always be kind of that dark light in his career. And it's probably got a lot of, you know, old school fans maybe not on his side for the rest of time. But, you know, you look at the numbers themselves, that's the part that really scares me. The 65% defensive striking for Renato Moicano, the 78% takedown defense and 60% takedown accuracy. In the guys he's fighting, the numbers he's putting up are very, very good. And, you know, you talk about the Demir Hadzovic fight. You know, that's a guy who was very angry at the end of the fight that he decided to take it to the ground. You know, I think that Moicano is also going into fights now with a lot smarter approach. He's not trying to get into these big fist fights, especially with guys that might be able to finish him. You know, those are great examples of where you're seeing Moicano, you know, grow as a fighter. Jay Herbert's another great example where a great striker had to neutralize, and I think that was a great fight for him. So, you know, you think about what Moicano has to neutralize. I think he's fought good enough guys to know that he cannot get hit, or he needs to avoid these big, powerful shots from Alexander Hernandez in the first round, because the last person to do it to him was Rafael Fiziev. And right now, if you're telling me that, you know, despite all the MMA math, you know, curses and stuff, but I just think the Fiziev-Alexander Hernandez gap is significant there, which tells me that Moicano should have the ability to avoid that first round damage. So with that said, we're going Moicano as a minus 140 favorite from a, you know, Vegas perspective. I think that there's enough reason to see bias to favor him, and the fact that it should still be close based on how much action Hernandez might be getting, minus 140 makes sense. So let's take a look here. I mean, this line not only hasn't moved, but Moicano is a clear favorite, so he's a minus 170, and this line has not moved anywhere past minus 180 on any major site, and Hernandez is pretty much sticking between that plus 140 and plus 150 range. So for me personally, I do like Moicano as a pick and a potential betting, or maybe a Super Saiyan pick, depending on how those weigh-ins go on Friday, but I think that's a very high-level fight that's going to have some pretty good implications down the line. Now we got pretty much ending the early prelims, which feels like forever. Leo Mana Martinez and Ronnie Lawrence. Now, what I love about Mana Martinez is I think he's going to be that typical guy that shows some underrated wrestling in this fight. You know, you look at some of the, you know, he's fighting his hometown. You look at some of the comments coming out of the Houston camps and saying how he's definitely a lot better than people are going to give him credit for going up against a guy like Ronnie Lawrence. Now, the thing with Ronnie Lawrence that I really do believe is he's hittable. I think I've noticed that enough times. The footwork's great. The wrestling and grappling's phenomenal, but he's hittable. And a guy like Mana Martinez, who's going to be quick on his feet, he's pretty tall for the division. He's going to be taller than Ronnie. I really like the striking that I see from him. I think that there's going to be opportunities for him to show off his game. And you think about the last time we saw him, it was in Adrian Yanez's corner. And that's the level of striker he is seeing on a regular basis, especially for this level of the UFC. And I think that you really have to give him a little bit more credit when it comes to, you know, maybe creating some of that early damage against Ronnie Lawrence. I think that the gas tank and the footwork and stuff like that is going to be a real pest to deal with over three rounds for Mana. But you know, having that poise, having that ability to pick his shots and avoid the takedowns. I mean, I am going to put Ronnie Lawrence as about a minus 200 favorite here, but I think that there's an opportunity for Mana to really steal a decision here. And to be honest, it should be closer to, I think, a minus 160. I would say that Mana deserves a bit more credit there, but I really think that for how much we've been hearing about Ronnie Lawrence and how good he's been in terms of, you know, that tough puzzle to solve, I think a minus 200 line makes sense here. So let's take a look. I mean, about 100 points higher, so it's minus 270 opener, now seeing about a minus 300 across the board. Mana's a plus 230. You can get him as high as a plus 250 at betonline.ag. So, you know, I think that one's pretty much writing on the wall. As a pick'em, am I leaning towards Ronnie Lawrence a little bit? But, I mean, as a betting pick, I mean, the striking that we've seen, you know, it was a split decision in his last fight. But, I mean, there is that dark horse opportunity, that, you know, out of left field type of style. So, I really like that fight to be exciting. And I think it's gonna prove to be that. Kicking off the next set of prelims, we got William Knight and Maxim Grishin. Now, in my personal opinion, right off the bat, I think this fight should be a pick'em for a handful of reasons. You know, first off, Maxim Grishin hasn't even lost back-to-back fights since 2009, and he got his break in the UFC by taking a Mersin Tabura heavyweight short notice fight, got beat up pretty bad in that one, and then two pretty good stints at 205. Now, the second one, Dustin Jacoby, you know, good first round, but you ended up losing the decision there. But he's got really good striking for his size, his age. He's got just a lot of experience under his belt, and you can tell that he absolutely loves the leg kicks. That's like one of his go-tos. But now we're talking about a guy like William Knight. The big thing for me with William Knight is you talk about even a guy who looks like he should gas pretty quickly, but somehow, some way, looks the part in the third round like nobody's business. He's got really good, you know, in close skills, some quick shots, some grappling. He's been working on the striking overall, and you can tell in some of his previous fights. And even with that 5-inch reach advantage for Maxim Grishin, it's just, is he going to be able to avoid William Knight for three straight rounds? Because if he can't finish William Knight early, unfortunately, this is going to be a very grind style fight, which is what William Knight absolutely loves. And to be honest, the gas tank coupled with the ability to probably eat the shots early on tells me that this could be a William Knight, you know, typical fight where he should come out with the win. And it's just really funny to see these guys, you know, in terms of size, right? Even Maxim Grishin, just a little too big for that. He's a little too small for that heavyweight class, but then comes in looking all right for this. But that's where you're going to see just how much these two stack up. I think the weigh-ins and the face-ups are going to be so key here. I think William Knight's going to have an edge for me. But again, I think it's an absolute pick'em. And I think Grishin should get the favorite line just for being the bigger guy. Some of the things that we've seen from him in the past. And then on the flip side, you know, William Knight's had a few hiccups in his career as well. So let's go Grishin one, minus 140. I think that makes sense, but it's still a very close fight. Minus 190 opener for Grishin, and now minus 170. William Knight, plus 165, now but a plus 140, plus 145. Now, again, I think that just breaks down into exactly what we said. Grishin's going to be a pretty good striker with good length. He likes to throw the leg kick, so a lot of his strikes are going to help keep William at bay. So the line clearly dictates that the that bigger guy with good striking in a fight where, you know, someone's going to want to really get in close, they clearly favor the experienced striker in this one. But, you know, I think that that's a pretty good underdog to revisit later in the week. But let's move on to Alex Perez and Matt Schnell. Now, at first glance, I gotta assume that Alex Perez is one of the bigger favorites on the card against a guy like Matt Schnell. Now, it's not taking anything away from Matt Schnell. You know, you think back to that 2017 stretch that he had after, you know, the Ultimate Fighter. He looked really good. But then you could make the argument that by 2019, when he was about to fight Alexander Pantoja, like he was in that realm of potentially seeing flyweight gold. But unfortunately, Pantoja won that fight, and Pantoja's been flirting with that area for most of his career since joining the UFC. So I think in this case, you know, after that, Matt Schnell just, you know, I think that his ability to roll with the punches is getting a lot better. He's not so susceptible to the knockouts. But, you know, the Tyson Nam split decision, for example, that's a fight where you look at the Alex Perez's, and again, you don't want to play too much MMA math, but Figueiredo fight, you look at that one, and it's like, that really was more telling of how good Figgy was, in my opinion. The speed, the ability to level change, to read Perez, where he was going, what he was going to try to do. Like, that was much more telling, of the Figueredo's skill. But on the flip side, you know, Perez, I think, had a good run there. It just, we saw a lot of different things. The leg kick went over Formiga. Just a lot of different skill. But for me, the pace, the ability to change levels and be good everywhere. I think that Perez, even if he takes a lot of damage on the feet, he's going to have the chain. He's going to have the ability to kind of withstand the damage and find ways to win. I think Matt Schnell is going to have a problem with the level changing. I think that the speed, a lot of the reasons that, you know, you look at the Tyson M fight, you know, that was just a prototypical technical strength. Like, you put it this way, at 125, I just feel like the fight just didn't seem as quick as some of the other ones do. And in this case, like, you look at the Kaikara France fights of the world, it's just, when you look at Alex Perez, I see that flyweight style and that speed and just like that level changing at lightning quickness. And that for me is where I really do see a difference between these two. And I think on the flip side, like we said, technical striker, Matt's going to want to pick him apart. Now, I think that Alex Perez is fairly hittable, but the movement, the speed, the changing levels, like, that's so key for him. And that's where, for me, looking at the line, judging by where Matt Schnell's been and how good Perez was going into that title fight, I'm going to go Perez minus 180. I think Vegas is going to see it's fairly similar around there. So,
wow.
I can't believe I just yawned. And on top of that, Alex Perez is a minus 400 favorite. He opened that way and he's staying that way. Schnell plus 330. Some places are trying to screw you over with a line under plus 300. But at this point, if you believe in Matt Schnell, you should be looking for a line that's above plus 300. And for me, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that I like Alex Perez's skill set for this fight. And it's pretty clear that I'm going to take him in terms of a pick. Now, next fight, Roxanne Modafferi and Casey O'Neill. Now, a lot of people are saying this is Roxanne Modafferi's, you know, retirement fight. And the thing that's really interesting about this fight is you look at the way they both kind of fight over three rounds. You know, Casey O'Neill has that feeler first round where anything can happen. Maybe, you know, sometimes with like that Laura Procopio fight, things get a little too close for comfort, but she tends to get really good over the course of the fight, finds her footing, gauges distance. By the third round, she's basically having her way with anyone and everyone, both on the feet and on the ground. So that's something to take away. And you look at the way Roxanne Modafferi fights, it's kind of similar. You know, from a matchmaking perspective, I really like the idea that we're watching two fighters who get better with, you know, with time in terms of, you know, in the octagon. You look at Modafferi, she really does wait out her opponents. She actually deals with damage as much as possible in the first round, very durable, and then tries to outscore opponents, uses her ground game, the improving striking. But for me, when you watch her win, it's going to be close decisions. It's going to be probably second and third round wins after taking a good amount of damage in the first round. I'm trying to think of the most recent one. I think it was Andrea Lee. I'm going to just quickly double check that to make sure I'm not rusty with the amount of shit I keep in my head. Andrea Lee, September of 2020. So that one, you know, it was very much that. And by the third round, just Andrea was so tired and Modafferi just had her way with her. So in this case, I just really like Casey O'Neill in this fight. I mean, I can see myself very much not agreeing with the Vegas line. I'm going to say Vegas is going to put her about a minus 290. And to be quite honest, even as a parlay piece for me, just in terms of seeing some value, and it's just really tough for me, right? Especially with a girl like Roxanne Modafferi, who actually gets better with every round. It's not that I think that Casey O'Neill is going to lose this fight. It's just that I don't see that value if that's where Vegas puts the line at minus 290. But, you know, I really love her dirty boxing. I love the way Casey O'Neill fights. It's just she really comes off like one of those fighters the UFC is going to love, where she doesn't take a step back as much. You know, she really does have that technical inside striking, likes to work the groundwork, always looking for finishes. She really is kind of that prototypical fighter that we want more and more of. And so let's take a look at the line. I went minus 290 for our girl Casey O'Neill, and you know what, bang on for the opener, minus 285 opener. We went with minus 290, but the public has bet that right up to minus 400. Modafferi now can be seen as high as a plus 315 after opening at plus 245. So for me, you know, if you're going to go with Modafferi, you might as well take a stab at the decision. I just don't know if she's going to be able to finish Casey O'Neill, even if it's on the ground. And with Casey O'Neill, I mean, one of those things where I just think that even in terms of calling the finish or the decision, I think it's tough. I personally think it's a little tough. I think maybe in the third round she might be able to do so much damage that she might get more of like a ground and pound style from top position. But let's get into the next fight. The featured prelim, Andrei Arlovski and Jared Vandera. I think that this is going to be one where it's really tough to call. It's weird because, like, you got a guy with, like, is Andrei Arlovski considered a GOAT? Because, like, I really think he is. MMA and fighting in general are two different things. Like, you think about the Robinsons of the world in the boxing game. It's like not everything is just about the undefeateds and the looking the prettiest. It's like when you dedicate yourself to this art over the course of time that he has and put together the highlight reels and the, you know, resume that he has, I think that's the part that really makes you just, you know, jaw drop at Andrei Arlovski's career. And for me, will always be a hero of this sport. And, you know, you talk about a guy like Jared Vandera, who's very much, you know, coming in, maybe not later in his career, but he's now on the come up. He is finding his way through the UFC. You talk about some of the tougher fights, a guy that's gone 2-2 in. I'm sorry, it's pretty late here. He's gone 2-2 in his UFC fights, and it's like the Taffa fight for me was the most impressive. I think Taffa came out after with x-ray showing just how broken his hand was, if I remember correctly. But in that fight, you specifically see just how much better Jared Vandera was getting from that previous fight, you know, the Harry Hunsucker fight. Again, you know, was able to get that top position, was able to fill him with strikes. But there's a very interesting factor in the two losses for Jared Vandera. And when you can take Jared Vandera down to the ground, it seems like a pretty good way of not only scoring a round, but tiring him out and making him not so, you know, prone to good striking in the third rounds. You know, you look at him in that Taffa fight, and a lot of good head movement, a lot of good footwork, was throwing kicks and attacking the body well. He was using his length to land the jab pretty well. And Taffa can take a punch, and he was just trying to get in there and get some good things going, but he just couldn't. And that's the third round we're talking about. So I really believe the key to beating Jared Vandera, doesn't matter who you are, is to find that takedown. He just hasn't been able to pull off a win in any fight where that's happened. And, you know, small sample size of four fights, but you can always tell when, you know, the good wrestlers, for example, they enjoy the top position on the ground, but when it comes to being on the bottom, a lot harder technically to get out. It takes a lot more of your energy to come out of those positions. And I think that's where we're seeing, you know, Jared Vandera's that prototypical style. Fighting at a Team Quest, it's like, you know, you couldn't paint the picture of a guy who loves probably, you know, the striking game leading into top position and maybe some ground and pound type of work. But in this case, you know, Andrei Arlovski is going to be the more technical fighter with a bit more probably under his belt just in terms of arsenal. But again, I love Jared Vandera's movement in that fight against Taffa. And the big thing for me is that chin of cement should hold up very well. Whereas with Arlovski, we have seen him prone to getting knocked out. But I've heard a lot of good arguments for why Arlovski might be overrated in this fight just based on the wins that he has put together with the Bozos and the Felipe Linzes of the world. But I don't ever look at it that way personally because, you know, there's a skill set, especially for a guy like Arlovski with so much tape. You kind of know what you're getting, and you really have to analyze Jared Vandera from the perspective of, does he have the power early on to get through this? Because I think that if he has to go three rounds in an Arlovski striking only fight, it's still going to be competitive. Add in the game plan of trying to score that takedown and work some top position, I really think Arlovski has an opportunity here. And fighting out of, you know, American Top Team and having all of those, you know, good game plan type of coaches around you, I think this would be one where you just have to put the, you know, I guess the feather in the cap of Arlovski. I think the UFC is giving him fights where he does have that opportunity to climb and work himself into a pretty good area of retirement or whatever the end holds for him. But you know, you talk about the fact that he hasn't landed a takedown since 2018, and it all kind of comes together in the end. So I want to go with Arlovski as a minus 160. If it's a standing-only fight, I just think that Vandera can play spoiler there, which makes this a very tough fight to call. So I want to go with Arlovski as minus 160, but given game plans, anything can happen. And wow, I mean, you can tell we know what we're doing here a little bit because a minus 300 opener for Arlovski, people bet Vandera so hard at plus 250 that he's now come down to about plus 115, plus 120. And to be quite honest, you know, Betway, for example, having about minus 175 and plus 130, that's a huge discrepancy from when you can see him at plus 120 and minus 140. So keep that in mind. This fight is actually getting pretty close to a pick 'em, and that's exactly what we just said, because it comes down to, you know, a lot of these fights we just kind of mentioned how that first round kind of goes, because there is, you know, good habits across the board for fighters in the third rounds for a lot of them. And then you have the cases of where if someone doesn't get knocked out, I mean, how are they going to look? So I like the line from where it's heading in terms of movement. It kind of lines up with what we're saying. You really want to give Andre Arlovsky the bump, boom, minus 300 opener, but then you do your work, you see where the public's mind's at, and then boom, comes all the way down to under minus 150, you know, with still 3 days left before fight night. So I can see that one coming down to a pick'em, and if you're a fan of Jaron Vandera, I would say take that as quickly as possible. And now we get to kick off that main card, man. I don't even know what to say about this first fight with Bobby Green and Nasrat Haqparast, because you look at the way that both guys fought in their last fight. It's like not only elite level competition, but they showed up pretty well. I think the Dan Hooker fight was a little bit more of a gap, I think, from a general perspective of most people watching. But when you talk about the Bobby Green fight and Rafael Fiziev, it's like, if you didn't notice how good of a defensive striker Bobby Green is while putting himself in dangerous places, that fight solidified it. Edge of your seat entertainment. You know, Bobby Green is clinically always keeping his hands down, but strategically able to kind of use the shoulders. You'll see Bobby Green do this a lot, and that's to really kind of use that shoulder and chin to kind of, that shoulder and that fist to kind of protect his chin. But this is going to be one where that left hand, that big powerful southpaw in Nasrat is going to try and land. You saw the body kicks coming in from Fiziev, and Bobby took those like nothing. And you even think about, you know, what we would consider the pandemic era. Is there a hotter fighter than Bobby Green in that time? You know, in 2020, in 2020, I mean, incredible, you know, incredible run in the UFC, and it culminated into, you know, last year's fight with Fiziev, which could be a fight of the year candidate for a lot of people. So, you know, you think about the fact that he's 5-3 with just one finish via strikes. For Nasrat, that's a huge telling of the tape for me, because he came in as a guy with such good highlight reel finishes, so much power. But, you know, in those five wins to only get one of those big finishes, I mean, it just goes to show the level of competition in the UFC, especially as strikers. And the thing for Bobby, it's like, Ally Quinto was considering a comeback and then took on a guy like Bobby and just got absolutely dismantled. It just shows you where this sport has gone over that period of time as well, say 1 to 2 years. And I really am excited for what kind of striking clinic we're going to see between these two, because one thing I'll always applaud is it's not even the ability to throw strikes, but it's the ability to avoid them and defend them. And you're talking about two guys who really are in the elite class of defense. You know, Haqparast comes in with a 71% striking defense, whereas Bobby Green comes in with 62%. But again, I think that Haqparast is also a safer fighter. I think that Bobby's going to put himself in a lot more dangerous positions, like with a guy like Fiziev, that was very obvious. And, you know, that those numbers kind of spell itself out when it comes to differential. But such an elite fight. And I think it's going to come down to Bobby Green's ability to basically translate this fight into any area he wants. I think that from a ground perspective, he has the ability to change levels and really fake him out if he needs to. He's got the speed and he's got the durability and pace to absolutely, you know, on any given day, take on anybody in the UFC. I would say, I think that he has an opportunity there. And that's why people, you know, big cappers are always talking about how they hate dealing with Bobby Green, because they don't know what version they're going to get. But right now, I think the one thing you can say from a consistency perspective is you're getting a very good version. Now, I don't know if it has so much to do with the version of Bobby Green you're getting or the people he is fighting as he moves up. You know, the Thiago Moises fight arguably could have been a W. A lot of people thought he won that fight, and, you know, he would have been in lightweight title contention by the end of that year if that were the case. So I like Bobby Green as a minus 175 favorite here. I think that you analyze Haqparast as a fighter and where he should have major strengths. And frankly, Bobby Green's chin, his ability to roll with punches and fire counters, his ability to change levels when he needs to and really control scrambles. I just think that's, if I see the types of Bobby Green fights that we have, you know, I think Nasrat's going to have a bit of an issue there. So let's go with that minus 170 and see where we lie. Okay, so this line's actually pretty close. We were pretty close to the opener, so minus 160 opener, pretty close to our minus 170, but it's moving closer to a pick-up, plus 138 opener for Nasrat. Now he's actually as close as a plus 110 with Bobby sitting as a minus 140. And I got to be honest, like, I really think that Bobby's got a good chance in this fight. I think the southpaw aspect, the elite striking aspect, could be something where you see, Bobby get outpointed. I think that's a very real possibility, which is what we saw before. But you keep your hands down, the possibility of getting hit is there. And, you know, I think that's where the line is definitely shifting down, because Hypras deserves a lot of credit as an elite level striker, and so that should be a good one to watch. Now, this is probably my most questionable fight on the main card, but you can tell the UFC is not only trying to sell the 135 division even more, but, you know, very exciting fighters. I think these are the guys that are going to absolutely throw down. Kyler Phillips in terms of a first-round fighter, and Martrell Arroyo is a first-round fighter. You look at both of their stats, you look at both of their highlight reels, insane. Insane action. I think that Kyler Phillips, for me, the one fight that stands out even going into this one in terms of tape to study and even similar approaches, you know, Martrell Arroyo, for example, his boxing in close is very good. I like the way he attacked Charles Jourdain's body. He landed some really good shots as he got in close and filled him up with a couple jabs. The moment he got in, he gave him one right under the elbow there. And obviously, we know how that fight played out, right? Took a lot of damage. It was getting more and more in the third. We already know that Jourdain gets better and better as the fight goes on. And so that finish in the third round finish. But Royal had his moments. He looked pretty good in that fight. Obviously, you know, very competitive in the first two rounds. I'm not going to say either fighter won or lost. I mean, you can maybe be the judge of that. But finish in the third. I did like the output. I did like the combos. And I did like the boxing. Now, with Phillips, it's like you get that longer style. And going back to my Yadong Song point, it's like that was a fighter who was not only, you know, very strong, but he had good wrestling background, had great hooks, and worked the body well. And to be honest, you know, we saw Kyler Phillips really be able to deal with that. And I think that forward backward movement is where, you know, Kyler's lateral movement is really, really good. And I think that this is going to be a fight where Martrell Arroyo is going to be bringing that, you know, slightly classic style boxing where it's in and out, looking for those, you know, fill shots. But with Kyler, you're just getting such a different array. Movement is there. Length is there. So for me, it's just really tough to see him losing this fight, especially based on how we saw both guys fight before. You talk about the mental aspect of the Paiva fight. You know, that should have been a draw on his record. And you really think that a guy who goes through something like that is going to really want to bring his A game for the next one. And I think, you know, going back to the one main point, I think the UFC's putting this on the main card, is you look at how many first round finishes both these guys have. You can tell they're trying to make something happen here. So for me, I do like the ability for both guys to stay durable for three rounds. I think that Martrell Arroyo might actually have a bit of an edge there. Phillips looked very out of place against Paiva in that one fight, but only in some areas. That's where I really do believe he earned that draw, and that fight might actually kick this one into gear. And I was going to say, probably one of the best bets to consider here as well would be an under. And I was actually going to quickly take a look at that one for you guys. We already did one of them, the Charant and Ullberg fight. Unfortunately, zero value with that -334 to not go the distance. But let's take a look at what Phillips and Roa, you know, not as bad, right? I think the Royo and Phillips fight 2.5 rounds is -188, with the fight to go the distance sitting about -225. So again, two fights that we kind of have a Vegas lean on it not going the distance, but, you know, a little bit too much juice there to pay, at least for the Ullberg fight. You know, if you really believe that Kyler Phillips and Martrell Arroyo are going to be able to finish this fight, I think a parlay piece of -225 is some good money there. But outside of that, let's take a look at the lines. I'm going to go Kyler Phillips -160. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for him to win. I think this line could go as high as -200, maybe higher. But outside of this, for me to see -300 lines, I follow so many sports. It's like, for me, that has to be something very glaring. But I think a -160 to a -200 line makes sense here. So let's take a look. Wow, open as a -300, now as high as a -425. So when you know guys are this far apart, it's really tough to see. But Martrell Arroyo +325 in some places. So obviously not giving enough credit to Kyler Phillips, or maybe giving too much credit to Martrell Arroyo based on Vegas's opinion here. But based on our line here, we obviously think this is going to be a lot closer of a fight. We do think Kyler Phillips is going to win, but, you know, to see a -400 line, that I do believe makes Kyler Phillips the biggest favorite on this card. So stay tuned for that one, because that's going to be a point to prove come the end of fight night. And That takes us into the three most anticipated fights of the night, I assume, with Jared Cannonier and Derek Brunson. Now, there was an interview or a little tidbit that I saw of Derek Brunson a little while ago, and I've been on him for three straight fights. I truly believe in Blonde Brunson, and the comment that he made was, when you go back and look at the tape, you see where he makes errors. Now, for a fighter to be so aware of that and be so disappointed in himself, to pinpoint, you know, specific areas where he lost his game plan or he lost his, you know, fighter IQ, it's so easy for him to not make that mistake, as opposed to some of the other losses that we see where the fight could have then gone a bit better for him. And in that sense, with him looking more elite now, he's been blowing through the competition. And the big thing I want to say for Derek Brunson before we get into Jared Cannonier, who is a phenomenal kickboxer that we've seen come from heavyweight all the way down to middleweight, is Derek Brunson did take on three strikers, right? We got Shahbazyan, Holland, and Till. So as much as we want to give Jared Cannonier the bump as the best striker, we know that Derek Brunson has taken on some pretty good strikers over his last few fights and come out pretty damn good. So Jared Cannonier, what did we see? You know, the Robert Whittaker fight was one where we really got to see him take on, you know, championship level fighters. I think that that's a case where in the middleweight division, you basically have what's left is the Izzy and the Whittakers. I really think that that's a tier. And I even with Whittaker, like, he's going to have a lot to prove after that first fight in this one, despite having such an incredible track record leading into the second fight with some very good improved striking. But, you know, I really think that Jared has a little bit more to prove when it comes to just how well of a good of a striker he is. Because if he can't clip Derek early, this is going to be a very long fight for him. You know, 62% takedown D is a little bit concerning. And the one thing he's got going for him is I think it's improving over the years. You think about a 62% takedown defense. You talk about a guy who's come down from heavyweight. Like, he's had to see some reps with some pretty big dudes. And for me, I think that also plays into his favor just going to this fight, right? Could be an underrated part of his game where 62% takedown D is concerning, but he also blocked all eight takedowns from Kelvin Gastelum in his last fight. So I really think that this could be one where it's really close. You know, I think that there's a wrestler that is showing a lot more fighter IQ. I don't think I'd make the argument that his striking is looking a lot better per se, despite it being that. I think that he's just being a lot more patient, a lot smarter, and finding his areas to win the fight, as opposed to just trying to, you know, the big thing with Brunson is I always say this, he tends to fight his opponent's fight, especially when he's in those desperate areas. You know, the Izzy fight, all of a sudden he's just going crazy trying to land big blows and gets clipped the way he did. That, for me, is what Derek Brunson needs to avoid. And to be honest, it's what Blonde Brunson does avoid. And, you know, he hasn't lost since 2018, which actually was the worst year of his life. And, you know, the 5-0 since then, I mean, in my opinion, I don't even think he needed to fight this. I think he was, you know, well-deserving of a title shot after that. But, you know, guys like Sean Strickland already saying, like, if Jared Cannonier wins this fight, you know, he's paid his dues. He deserves that title shot for whoever wins that. It could be a rematch against Whittaker or a first-timer against Izzy. But, you know, that's the part for me that I'm enjoying the come up of some of these fighters, just because it's like we're running out of some really good talent at the middleweight level. And, you know, we'll get into the main event soon enough, but in this fight I have to go Brunson at about a -130. I just think that what he does well and where we're seeing improvements is exactly where he needs to be good against Jared Cannonier. Patient, avoid the big shots, wait for your openings. You know, even if you have to land some of your own strikes or use some combos to just get into change levels, do that. You know, I think that there are areas in Cannonier's game that he has to try and exploit to see just how good he is. And if, you know, he defends those takedowns, he's gonna have to have a plan B. But that's where I see Brunson having an edge. So I'll go -130 for Derek Brunson. He's just got a lot of good tape going for him right now. And the holes that he's fixing make a lot of sense. Wow. Derek Brunson coming in again as an underdog. I mean, it's been so nice, you know, reaping the benefits over the last little while. But, you know, it's a tough one. I do have a lean on Derek Brunson, but it's clear that that hunch on Jared Cannonier is for real, because he opened as a -125 favorite. This fight was basically a pick'em, and now you can get Jared as high as a -182. That blows my mind, and for me, it really does come down to a dog or pass style of fight, because at the end of the day, to get a guy like Derek Brunson, who's been on the trail that he is, to see him as a plus 145 dog against a guy like Jared, who, yes, has the knockout power, has the experience, and even could have the underrated takedown defense now that we've seen him at middleweight, even against a guy like Kelvin Gastelum, that he could supplant Derek Brunson pretty easily. But I think that Derek Brunson is definitely working on his game as much as possible. He just seems so much smarter and a lot more versatile. So we'll have a final pickup for that one, as always, on Instagram and now Twitter. But that's going to be a very close fight. And the line is a little bit moving in the opposite direction that I would expect. But that leads us into our co-main event with Derek Lewis and Tai Tuivasa. And it's very clear how I feel about Derek Lewis, and I just wish this man would get the respect that he deserves, and he's kind of just, you know, earning it as he goes. The big thing for me is he's, I think, improving more as an athlete here, and I think Tai Tuivasa is in that same place as well, but now we get into the IQ level. I think that Tai Tuivasa just doesn't have the experience that Derek Lewis does. Derek Lewis has also been knocked out a few times in his career, and we've seen Tai Tuivasa deal with some serious blows as well. The big thing, I just cringe for Tai Tuivasa for how much I love the guy. When he gets in close, it's like he's willing to take a few blows to then land some big shot against you. But when it's Derek Lewis, do you really want to be taking one or two blows from him? That's the big question for me, because I know for a fact that with Derek Lewis, you're getting a bit more of that technical brawler style. I think that he's able to pick his shots pretty well. His timing looks really, really good. The best example that we've seen in recent dates is the Curtis Blaydes fight. That was absolutely beautiful. Another fight where I had Derek Lewis picked with my eyes closed. It's all about decision making to me in the heat of the moment. And Derek Lewis, unless he's facing some very, very, very good strikers, he tends to find his way. And so for me in this one, it really comes down to how good of a striker you see Tai Tuivasa. And unfortunately, do I think he's on the Junior Dos Santos, the Ciryl Gane, level of things right now? I just don't see it. I personally do not. And for me, that's where it's like really easy to say Tai Tuivasa in the next 3 to 4 years could be, you know, a prime heavyweight contender, if not champion. But that's why I fall in love with the man, is like I really do see the progress. But in Derek Lewis's case, I think that the skill set now leading into the progress, I mean, the guy has the money now to get the medical attention that he's needed probably for a little while. And I think if he can avoid that early blow that might be irresponsible, which he probably pretty much doesn't find himself in very much, you know, I think that's the big thing. His IQ is just really, really good for that, you know, meathead looking brawler. So I want to go Derek Lewis, but a minus 150 favorite. I think it just makes the most sense, you know, the improving athleticism, what we've seen from him lately. It really is going to be a tough fight for Tai Tuivasa. And I just think from an athletic perspective, he doesn't have those things that we usually see from the other fighters. So let's take a look. You know, hometown, discount, if you will, would absolutely not see Derek Lewis losing in Houston either. So let's take a look here. Derek minus, what did I say? Minus 150. All right, so he's about a minus 188. Pretty much hovering on that minus 180, minus 190 line. Tuivasa opens a plus 162. And I mean, he's between that plus 150 and plus 160 line. So I really like that fight from a fan perspective, and just the fact that, you know, for me, that's like a passing of the torch. I'm one of the biggest Derek Lewis fans on the planet, and I've been following Tai Tuivasa for a very, very long time and hoping, you know, that he does get that athletic aspect and that wrestling aspect and that MMA aspect of his game up, and it's exactly what he's done. So excited for that, and that takes us into our main event with Israel Adesanya and Robert Whittaker number 2. And so, you know, it's like I've got so many notes here that I might not even touch on, but Izzy and Stephen Thompson are the only people to ever really knock out Rob at this level. And that's really telling, right? It's the technical strikers with some really good underrated power in their fists that tend to pose problems for him. And the big thing I've been kind of reading in terms of storyline is just this idea that Izzy's a heel now, and since that first Robert Whittaker fight, he hasn't really been the guy that people want him to. And I don't know where people are getting their storylines, but I'm pretty sure that Israel Adesanya is one of the fastest growing stars of the sport, especially from an international perspective. It makes no sense to hear some of these, you know, anecdotes, if you will, on a guy that's just like almost becoming bigger than the sport, especially in his own home countries. And his fan base is probably one of the fastest growing over the last 3-4 years. So I'm going to put that one to bed. And let's quickly talk about that Yan fight, because it keeps coming up. I mean, people keep saying that Jan won with wrestling, but look at this, look at the numbers. Jan was actually a pretty good striker in that fight too. I mean, you know, I just, it's hard for me to keep hearing that argument. I think Jan's a pretty good kickboxer and he just fights at a much higher weight class. He's a bigger guy. And that's where in a lot of ways, you know, he was able to deal a lot more damage to Izzy than the average fighter can, especially down at 185. So, you know, we talk about the same reasons why GSP never wanted to, you know, leave 170. And to be honest, I think it's for those reasons. He did not want to tarnish that legacy. And for his style of winning, to go up a weight class would be so detrimental to that. So, you know, you have to give Israel a lot more credit for going up than take away anything from his, you know, in my opinion, look at the guy, just an MMA, you know, MMA middleweight. And the guy's pretty damn good. You know, you want to switch up his records, even that's an option. Maybe something people start doing 10 years, 20 years from now when, you know, it just gets too depleted in terms of skills. But that then leads me into the Vettori fight. Now, if Vettori is really trying to sell that he, you know, won that fight, I mean, you have to, you know, in the moment, maybe you can, you know, try and see where he's coming from, but you look at the numbers and you really gauge what happened in that fight. And it's like, think about what Jan did. You know, he was able to win the control game, the wrestling game, but was able to show damage in that time, especially when they were standing still. You have to dominate if you're going to use cage control and wrestling as a means to a win. I think that Marvin Vettori did not do that. I think that enough of the takedowns were defended. I think it was it? Yeah, 4 of 14 takedowns. And, you know, I think Adesanya uses leg kicks very effectively against the wrestlers. And so, you know, you think about him getting just over 7 minutes of control time in a 5-round fight. I mean, I just don't see the argument there. Israel Adesanya could quite possibly be, pound for pound, one of the most elite fighters we have in the UFC to date. And the only reason I say that is his variety of wins and how he does it. I mean, look at the Vettori, look at the Costas of the world. It's just such different game plans required to win. And he, in my opinion, from what my eyes can see, absolutely dominated the both of them. I think wrestlers naturally can find ways to make it look a lot closer. It's what they do. But in that case, from an MMA fight, it was an absolute mauling. And I think that's where Israel's almost being downplayed in a way, because his fights are so technical at this level. You know, you're not going to just run around knocking everybody out with your eyes closed. So I really want to give him so much more credit than what I'm hearing in terms of storylines going into this one. And let's talk about Rob and Whitaker 1. I mean, another thing you can hear, and this is not even storyline, this is a commentator, I can't remember who, but in the fight, you can hear a commentator say, you know, say Izzy is starting to respect Robert's power in the fight, and that's right. No, I, to be honest, I so disagree with that statement. And it's like, even here, I've written like many timestamps, because even by like 3 minutes of that first round, you see that was the moment where Izzy started gauging Rob's distance. So by that 3 minute mark in the first round, you know, Izzy was doing a lot of waiting and seeing, a lot of these lunges coming at him. All of a sudden, his ability to dodge the strikes, his ability to move and maybe try to counter, was becoming so much more easier. So it took Izzy basically 2 minutes in that fight to gauge distance of at least Rob's side to then be able to move and really just, everyone talks about it, right? He's able to just quickly glance. These punches are flying by him. It's like he sees it in slow motion, fly by him. Now, by that 1 to 2 minute mark in the first round, now Izzy's gaining his range. Now, not only does he know what Robert is throwing at him and is able to gauge how to roll off of that and fill up counters, but now he's gauged his range. So when Rob's coming forward and throwing these things, not only can he move, but he can now stick. And so for me, I really like what I saw in that fight, because by the 1 minute mark, Izzy was alive. Basically knocked him out twice in that fight. It's funny, I was going to use that as a line, and he does it in the countdown, but it's true. I mean, he's already knocked out Rob twice. And one of the things you'll notice, you rewatch that fight, watch Rob in the corner after that knockout. I mean, it's almost a little scary, because he's 100% trying to look at the screen to see what happened. Even when his coaches are talking to him, he's really trying to figure out where he's at. And I think going into that second round, he was already a little wobbled, and the lunging continued. And Israel found his way. And exactly like that timestamp shows, I mean, by that 1 minute mark in that first round, he never looked back. The second round was basically domination. I think that there was a point where it was 11 for 22 strikes for Izzy and 11 for 22 for Izzy and 12 for 44 for Robert. So 12 for 44 versus 11 for 22. You obviously can see where the efficiency was coming from in that second round. And frankly, I think Robert paid the price for just continuously lunging in, losing a bit more of his gas tank with all that volume being thrown. Just a lot of lunging. And you know, he got caught pretty badly there. So that is my take on the first fight. Now you can get into, you know, how much better Robert has looked in terms of movement, boxing. That is the major key here. Just his striking, if that was any indication of how his striking was going in that Izzy fight, it's oceans apart now. That Gaslam fight was a clinic. It was a boxing clinic. He did such a wonderful job there. And, you know, even before that, like, I just think that between the Cannoneer fight in the Gaslam fight, you can see just how good of a striker Robert's becoming. And now he's going to get the ultimate test with Israel. So obviously, everyone's going to say Robert's got to change levels. He's got to be able to wrestle him. He's got to be able to, you know, win the point battle in case the striking is just going so poorly. And the only way he's going to be able to do that is set up some combos to be able to open up the level changes, get in some clinch work, really force Israel into some dirty areas. Because even in the first fight, in the parts that he was winning, which was the first 2 minutes of the first round, he was keeping him guessing. You have to just do that a little bit more consistently and a lot less telegraphed would be the way I'd put it. Because by the 3 minute mark, it was just the tide started turning in a big way. So I'm going to have to put Izzy in from a Vegas mindset at minus 175. I personally think this line should be about a minus 130, minus 140. I just think that the improvement on Whitaker's side and the fan base and everything like that, just as a Vegas line, should bring it a bit closer. But minus 175 makes the most sense as the opening line. And so let's take a look here. Wow. So Izzy opened as a minus 188. Now he's sitting at a minus 275, as high as a minus 280, guys. Robert Whitaker opens as a plus 140 and now as high as a plus 220. So that just goes to show where people really see where Israel's at. I think for me, it's going to come down to how well Robert Whitaker can disrupt Israel's flows and be able to kind of change the gear very, very often. The moment you stand and trade is the moment that Izzy starts to line things up. And even the way that the final blows went in that first fight, that's what I mean by my timelines. By that first minute in the first round, Izzy not only didn't respect Rob's power, but he was now willing to just get into those dirty places and start firing things off and see what happens. And then boom, by the second round, it was like, let me take a few shots and then land this beautiful counter. And so I think that's where the tail of the tape kind of lies. We know where Robert has to be better to be able to win this fight. And I think that's the beautiful part of this is Robert, again, just like Israel, looks at this like a game. He's leveled himself up. He's gone through a few test rounds with some other fighters to be able to get back to the spot, see how much better he is in those areas, and give it his all for a second time. And so I'm very excited for this card. I've given you a couple good bets to look into and also a few picks already. But as always, final picks will be in Instagram stories and also now on Twitter every single Saturday once we get that beautiful little graph that the UFC Twitter account puts out. As always, we are now going to start a schedule of Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on YouTube and Spotify for the official Suki MMA Pick'em show. And after that, we're going to get a whole bunch of things rolling off of that schedule. So keep it locked to Suki MMA. I'm so excited to get things rolling again. And again, you know, we're about a month away from the 1 year mark on March 13th. So let's finish the year strong. Let's try and get into the, you know, over 500 pick'em record, but let's keep winning some money on these fights. You know, it's not a big part of my thing. I'm not a handicapper, but I definitely enjoy doing that since, you know, it's a nice little present on top of, you know, analyzing the fights the way I do. So keep it locked to Suki MMA. Like, follow, subscribe, and definitely leave a comment. Looking forward to it. And as always, peace.